Robin, thank you so much for coming on today. I'm so excited to talk to you because you are the epitome of a badass. I mean, you've gone from finance to starting a non-for-profit to where I first met you, reading a book when I got into my whole like healthy living world. Like, what was that? Almost 18 years ago, 15 years ago? I don't even know, 20?
Yeah, the book came out in 2009. Yeah. It feels like 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, so a long time ago. So that's where I first heard about you. And then you went on to start this non-for-profit. And you're now back into the finance world. So I'm just so excited to kind of dive into your path, just because you're a true entrepreneur. And so what took you from finance to starting that non-for-profit?
You're right. I come from a very entrepreneurial family. My dad is an entrepreneur, started his own business. So I grew up seeing what it was like for someone to work for himself, the flexibility that he had, the ability he had to build the business that he wanted. And I knew that I wanted to have kids. It was why I'd gone to business school. Because I wanted that flexibility. I studied a lot of entrepreneurship coursework when I was in business school. So, you know, it was very intentional and it's definitely in my DNA. And I started a website called Allergy Kids when the kids were little to educate parents about food allergies and the risks and the different opportunities to get involved. And it was just really an informative website because at the time, other organizations charged a fee for you to have access to the information. And I thought, that's crazy. Parents need to be able to protect their kids. So let's get this information out there. And the more that I continued to populate that website, the more research I was doing. And it was really drawing from experience that I had had in the investment world. I was a financial analyst on a team that managed $20 billion in assets before becoming a mom. So it enabled me to sort of keep one toe in that, you know, and I was still in touch with a lot of the analysts that had covered the food industry as I was researching food allergies. And then, as you know, all of a sudden, you know, I started pulling on this thread in the research, and what resulted was my book, The Unhealthy Truth. So that in and of itself is a business venture. Becoming an author is an experience quite unlike anything else. You think you're going to get a lot of support along the way, and it really requires a lot of sweat equity. It was fascinating. It was a fascinating experience to write a book that was so enormously controversial, calling out, you know, the pollution in the food system, the double standard, how science had been for sale, much like the tobacco industry science, you know, was sort of feeding into the profitability of the industry. And again, I was able to leverage this experience that I had had in the finance world, plus being a mother of four. And somebody said, you know, it's a real 360. So after authoring the book, I started the Allergy Kids Foundation, which was a non-for-profit. And again, it was really to continue to educate and inspire parents. I felt that the diagnosis of food allergies could be pretty terrifying, and I didn't want people to feel like their life was over. That's how it had felt when my daughter had first been diagnosed. I thought, I am not equipped as a mother to handle this condition. And something as simple as feeding a child suddenly became very complex. And I thought, the more information we have, the better. And the more support that we have, the better. So it was always, you know, from the beginning, intended to be a very supportive platform. And I knew that as a mother of four that I couldn't do everything myself. And so I really invited a lot of collaboration early on in the work. I knew that I didn't have science in the background. So I had amazing science advisors who are still very dear friends today. They're some of my most trusted contacts when something comes up, to be able to use them as sounding boards. And they really have, all of them, gone on with just remarkable careers over the last 15 years. And then as I continued to really speak out about this with the book and the website, I was invited to give a TED Talk. And like, you know, some of my friends from high school, it was a friend that I had played soccer with in high school who connected me to the curator. And that was really the game-changing moment. And that was in 2011. And with that TED Talk, you take this stage. It is very raw and is very vulnerable. And you have the opportunity to tell a story. And I had learned through publishing my book, you know, that the publishing house has a lot of control over the title and the way the book is packaged and the artwork. And there were things about it that, in hindsight, now I know if I were to go through it again, I would push a lot harder to have a title and artwork on the cover of a book that resembled my message. But at the time, it wasn't that way. So it was a very sort of terrifying approach that had been presented with the book. And I felt that when I had the opportunity to give the TED Talk, it was really, I got to stand on the stage and just be. And I said a quick prayer before I started to just let my heart speak. That was a game-changing, absolutely life-changing event. What happened after that is something you cannot prepare for. The talk went viral and it's been translated into dozens of languages and viewed by millions of people around the world. But the thing that happened was the CEO of Nestle's frozen food division reached out. And he said, you can say things I can't say. Could you come out here to Ohio and meet with us? And that was not what I expected at all. When the book had been published, I had been attacked by the industry. A couple of the companies, multinational food companies, had been very aggressive in their attacks. And so it was a complete surprise to have the CEO reach out, and also incredibly validating. And it was really the first time that I felt like we had the possibility of really fixing this. And then that's what continued to happen. So I spent about 15 years running a consulting firm, a strategy firm called Do Good that I founded. And it was really just to help these companies do good. And some of them were little, some of them were in the allergen space, some of them were multinational food companies, but to really work at a very high level to help them understand that the shift that was happening with consumers wasn't a fad or a trend, that we were asking for a fundamental change in the way that they were formulating their products, and that we wanted them free from these junky ingredients that they weren't using overseas, free from genetically engineered ingredients, free from as many of these pesticides as they could get out of it. And it had been fascinating work, which then led me to where I am today, which is as a co-founder of Replant Capital. And what happened there was, as I was working with these multinationals, Nestle was a great example. It took them 7 years to release the USDA organic allergen-free Nestle morsel after we had had that first meeting. And that email that I got 7 years later was, we finally did it. And I thought, this is amazing. And it's also like turning the Titanic.
Yeah.
And I realized that they didn't have the supply chain they needed to meet the needs of 21st century families. And so, you know, now if you look up organic, 85% of consumers are trying something organic, 75% of grocery store categories carry something organic, and only 1% of our farmland's organic. So if I'm the CEO of General Mills, that math doesn't work. I can't source enough organic to meet the demand here in the United States. So we're importing it, and there's all kinds of checks along with that. So that was really sort of this aha moment where I was giving these back-to-back keynotes to General Mills and Nestle, and I thought, you guys, even if you had complete sign-off across the board, the supply chain isn't there. So how do we open the bottleneck of the supply chain? How can we provide capital that can help finance this transition to organic agriculture and do it in a way that accelerates this change? And so that's what we're doing at Replant. We have launched a $2 billion fund to help transition the supply chains of these multinational food companies at scale. And as you convert the supply chain to regenerative and organic agriculture to meet the needs of the consumer, you're also getting rid of these chemical inputs. That's better for soil health. And something I've learned along the way is that soil has this incredible capacity to serve as a vibrant sponge that when it is healthy, it can draw down carbon from the atmosphere and it can hold water. And so you have water conservation metrics that begin to emerge, and the bees return and the pollinators return, and suddenly it can hold carbon. And you know, here we are standing on this incredible asset and this incredible resource that's our soil. And we were just thinking about it only for the food products that are coming off. Well, at Replant, we recognize that not only as we convert these supply chains, yes, multinational food companies have more organic product. You know, we're able to do this at scale. It's more affordable to more people. But as you restore soil health, you've got this incredible environmental play. So it's been really, really exciting and fun to work on.
There's so many, like, I don't even know where to start to like start asking you questions, but just curious, just from my own personal, like what I've read, how much, because GMOs are such a, like Monsanto is such a major giant. So how have they played a part in, like, you know, I can't imagine unpacking that and undoing what they've kind of been creating and changing our soil over the past, I don't know how it's been, 20, 30 years. How do you just reverse course with that? I mean, are you finding new soil that they haven't touched, or are you going someplace else, or are you just kind of unwinding what they've done?
So what's amazing is that, like, you know how we talk about microbiomes of our gut, mm-hmm. you know, and everybody's like, oh, probiotics is microbiome, blah, blah, blah. Soil's the same. And so because it's this living, vibrant thing, you can actually restore soil health as you reduce the chemical inputs and begin to put different practices on the farm. Something as simple as planting cover crops so that you actually are getting those nutrients back into the soil. And it's an amazing process. And you know, I think what we're seeing is farmers need to unlearn this chemical input model and then in some cases learn how to steward the soil and learn how to put these regenerative practices on the farm. In some cases, for example, in the cases of Native American farmers and Black farmers, they've always practiced this way because mm-hmm. they didn't have access to capital. The capital was very discriminatory and mostly only available to white male farmers. And so farmers of color, you know, really had to always figure out how to steward the soil in a responsible way. But I think what's amazing is that it's a 3 to 5 year process. And so what happens is if you've got capital coming in from these big banks on the quarterly earnings model, you can't convert soil on a quarterly earnings model. Mm-hmm. It's a 3 to 5 year process. And that was the opportunity we saw at Replant was let's raise some capital that we can put to work over 3 to 5 years to convert these supply chains, give the timeline that's required to restore and build soil health, clean the chemical inputs out, you know, put these better practices on farm. And it's amazing. And when we talk to the growers themselves, you know, there's a guy in Indiana that we've worked with. He farms 7,000 acres and he used to grow genetically engineered corn and genetically engineered soy and use all the chemicals that are required to treat those crops. And he said in the first year of his transition, he saved $500,000 because he wasn't having to buy the chemical inputs. And I said, when did you know you were like clear on the other side? And he said it was around year 7 or year 8. And so, you know, what we have is a broken food system because of this broken financial system. And there's this weird timeline tension. So to be able to come in with capital and say, let's give you the capital you need on the timeline that you need to allow this practice to take place is really the opportunity. And I think that's why we get so excited, because it is so fixable. Once you stop polluting the soil and once you stop treating it with all of these chemical inputs, its ability to regenerate is so powerful. And the farmers see it themselves. And I think once those farmers sort of become these disciples of the practice, then it's just game changing, because then they're influencing their communities and other farmers are saying, hey, what are you doing? You know, it looks totally different on your farm than it does to mine. And they begin to teach each other. So, you know, as a team, we're just there as a supportive resource, really.
That's great. And then have most of your capital come from the bigger retailers, or where has your capital come from?
No, it's interesting. You know, we didn't want to take capital from the food companies themselves because we didn't want that to appear as a conflict of interest. So we're raising philanthropic capital from high net worth individuals and family foundations. And it's primarily coming from women. So my two co-founders, Don Schaefer and Dave Haynes. Dave was in private equity prior, and Don Schaefer was CEO of a group called RSF Social Finance out of California. And his client base there was 1,600 people, and about 80% of them were high net worth women. And it's been fascinating because I think as the primary shoppers and those that have leaned into this education around food and this food awakening first, women are coming into this quickly. And so our early investors are female, a lot of our cap table, female. And so it really has been a pretty fascinating process. And I think that's only going to continue to accelerate. One of my goals is to get this in front of Mackenzie Scott so that she recognizes, I mean, she alone could be absolutely monumental in changing the food industry and really, you know, having this incredible role towards this climate solution through agriculture.
Mm-hmm. And do you think most of these food companies started working with you when you started your consulting firm and started making changes because they had to because of their bottom line and there was request, or do you think they truly wanted to?
I think it's both. You know, I think early on, there was a lot of resistance. There was a lot of lobbying by the industry, by these giant companies against these changes because, you know, status quo is pretty comfortable until it's not. Mm-hmm. And what we saw was just all of a sudden, as it became clear that they were on the wrong side of the issue, a lot of the CEOs stepped out. And step down. And so what, as the new leadership stepped into these roles, you know, 15 years ago, if you're talking about autism and food allergies, it was a small audience. Today, unfortunately, it is a very big audience. And so at most of these companies, there are senior executives who are completely personally touched by some of these conditions. You know, 1 in 3 kids now has allergies, autism, ADHD, or asthma. And those are shocking numbers. Cancer is the leading cause of death by disease in kids under the age of 15. Horrible statistics. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's touching all of us. So that turnover at the top has been enormously beneficial because it's allowed the change to begin to flow through. It is also in their best interest for the bottom line. And so, you know, part of the tension that the food companies have right now is most of the executives inside the company themselves are like you and I. They understand there's this awakening is happening. They know what they're feeding their own families. The board maybe isn't quite as up to speed. And then the investors are just looking at margins and profitability. And I think the companies that have used the cheapest, most artificial ingredients and cranked out the most processed food are the ones that are really getting hurt. You look at Kraft, it just continues to implode. I'm in awe how many times it's imploded. And it's just because they're cost cutting and cost cutting and cost cutting to the point where it's like hardly resembles food. Mm-hmm. So that change is coming through the capital markets. But again, I think this is where I really push for equity and diversity and inclusion, you know, in governance, because with the capital markets being governed primarily by white male, again, they don't know what they don't know here. And the more that you have women and people of color and representation in a governing body, the greater your understanding is of the whole. And I think that's really the opportunity here. And we're starting to see it. You know, Goldman Sachs said they won't take a company public unless there's a woman or a person of color on the board. And, you know, that's a pretty low bar, but at least they have actually put a bar in place.
Right. No, it's true, because I think going back to this whole issue, I don't think most people, you know, I'm taking it also back to like the whole beauty counter that I've been involved with. People don't realize, most people don't realize that it's really not regulated at all, right? So like the food is somewhat regulated, but really it's very loose. People can get around a lot of the organic. What does organic mean? You know, right. Like, and where does that come from?
Well, exactly. And it's like, if it's coming in from another country, what's the third party verification there? And, you know, I think there's been some exposure. And I think that's also part of what the food industry saw was this sort of organic fraud that started to happen. So why not secure it here? Food security is national security. So why not secure the organic supply chain here?
I agree with that. And so what would you say, like, from your experience in building, you know, your non-for-profit and the book and now Replant Capital, what has been your hardest struggle? I mean, there's been so many. I don't think people kind of appreciate when you launched your book or when you wrote your book, no one really knew what GMOs were. That's how long ago, right? It was like the 12 years or 13 years ago, most people... Like, I remember saying to my friends GMO and they'd be like, what are you talking about? Really?
I know. I say all the time. I mean, when I was first speaking out on these issues, people kind of looked at you like you had three heads. No one knew what they were. And so, you know, you're saying there's something in the food that nobody's even heard of. And that's just almost like an impossible thing to believe that our government mm-hmm. would do that. I think it challenges our views of our government. It challenges a lot. And that early on was really hard. And I think, you know, articulating it with data was really critical. Consistency. And then, you know, it was just coming from this place of such deep love that it was unstoppable. And it will always come from that place. It comes from a very deep place. But I think the early years were enormously isolating. And in those early years, there was a grit and resiliency that was built because of it. Something I've learned is that, you know, when things were extraordinarily hard, those are the greatest lessons. So it's something I've taught my kids, you know, show me what the lesson is here in this hardship, because clearly it's sharpening me for something else. But yes, the attacks were really aggressive and very personal, but also, you know, the mission was so much bigger than me. So I think it was having that higher North Star that's always been part of the work. So, you know, I would say the isolation was what was so hard in the beginning, which is also what makes the team work now and the collaboration so much fun.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's great. Now, any other tips that you would give any entrepreneurial mom, woman, or someone who's actually in corporate America trying to make it to the top? Like, what other advice would you give them to be successful?
Ask for help, seek out mentors. You know, a great piece of advice I got was surround yourself with people that are smarter than you, you know, in areas where you're weak. Great advice. I think trying to be all things to all people, you're just destined for failure. So it's really recognizing what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are and building out around that. I think we do that as a team remarkably well at Replant. We all play to our strengths and we can recognize our weaknesses and turn to each other, you know, for support when we need to. The other thing I would say is don't be afraid to start small. You know, the first engagement I ever spoke at had six people. And, you know, one was a pediatrician and one was a nutritionist who was a friend. And I introduced them and they got married. So I figured that was kind of like a nice little blessing on top of that one. But don't be afraid to start small. I think what you have to be afraid of is not starting. And the other thing I've learned is that fear is really just like a seatbelt that keeps you in your comfort zone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you can name and identify fear, it really does help you move through it instead of being paralyzed for it. You know, I recognize it's just a companion on this road to change. And once you embrace that and stop being intimidated by that, it really is game changing.
These are amazing quotes, advice. I love it. And you amaze me with everything you've done. I mean, honestly, when I first read your book, in Healthy Truth, I was in awe of you and everything that you were doing because it was so cutting edge at the time. And just,
it really was, you know, and it's interesting when people read it now or like they watch the TED Talk now, and it's a timeless message. Mm-hmm. And there is so much opportunity to engage and change. I think one of the things I love the most is now if I go to these food industry events, there'll be somebody that saw that talk 10 years ago and then 2 years later started a company that's now 8 years old, you know, and I'm like, that's so cool. But, you know, I think it's one of those opportunities where there's room for everybody to collaborate. And I think in the 21st century, the way that we can leverage technology as it relates to learning about agriculture and as it relates to learning about food systems is fascinating. And then I think, you know, on the equity and justice piece, I mean, there's been so much discrimination in our food system and so much discrimination in agriculture. So that's an area that's just got enormous opportunity for engagement and involvement. I teach a class at Rice called The New Food Economy, and it's been really fun because there are just so many angles that you can come in. We had Seth Goldman speak, and he's the founder of Honest Tea, and he was executive chairman of the board for Beyond Meat. And talk about a serial entrepreneur. I mean, he is absolutely serial entrepreneur. He's somebody I admire so much. But it really, again, I think it's just, we get to co-create this, and that's what's so exciting.
Yes, it's so true. But thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. This has been amazing. And I just keep watching to see what you were doing and changing the food industry and all the impact that you're doing. So thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for reaching out. It's so great to reconnect. And thank you also for being there in the very, very beginning, because that was a small group and those people are very like close to my heart. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.